I'm broadcasting live. We're trying something new tonight. I stumbled upon something that YouTube is putting together. There's actually a live broadcast feature on YouTube now, with some kind of neat features. If you're already tuned in, you can see the... Anyway, I won't go into it. Let's just get started. But yeah, we have a chat now. So you can chat with me on YouTube. And I can see it. Let me know if there's any issues. Hopefully you can hear me now. If you can't, let me know. If there's any problems with the stream, let me know. Anyway. So tonight's teaching, again, we're continuing with the Anguttara Nikaya. So tonight's teaching is the third chapter of the Anguttara Nikaya. Which begins as the other ones do. Nahang bhikkhave anyang ekadhammampi samanupassami. Yeah, here's another neat thing I can do. Let me see here. Right. Now you should see, hopefully you see this. So we have another group of 10 suttas about the mind. I don't know if this is at all interesting. Let's go back to the other one. Hi. These suttas are about the mind. It's called the Akkhamaniya Vagga, the chapter on unwieldy, being unwieldy, that which is unwieldy. We talked about this word unwieldy, akkhamaniya, is the word. Kammaniya means you can work it or you can use it. Akkhamaniya means you can't use it. Anyway, so that's the first one. There are 10. And the general gist of this chapter is about the importance of the mind, the power of the mind, the efficacy of the mind, that the mind is efficacious, meaning it has an influence, it has an effect. What goes on in the mind has results. It's meaningful. It's not just what we would call an epiphenomenon, meaning something that occurs but has no effect on the system. This is really one of the most crucial aspects of the Buddha's teaching, or crucial points of doctrine in Buddhism. That the mind is efficacious, that the mind has an effect. The first verse of the Dhammapada, it's no coincidence that the first verse is Manopabhangama Dhamma. All Dhammas are preceded by the mind. That the mind is the beginning. For a long time, this has been sort of this has been denied by science, modern materialist science, because when you observe a system, a physical system, you don't see the mind. You can't observe the mind. The mind is not part of the system. And so for the longest time it was thought that because when we observe the system there is no mind, the mind doesn't really exist. It's just as someone explained to me, it's a surface phenomenon, like heat or color, meaning it's a result of what is real, but it's not real itself. It's like harmony. When you bang a tuning fork, the vibrations create sound. Now there's a great problem with that argument, but without going there, the interesting thing is in the 20th century, when quantum physics became prominent, they realized that they had missed an important part of the equation, that when you say observing the system, you forget to take into account the act of observation. And now that doesn't seem important from a material science point of view, but as quantum physics showed, it's crucially important. And that in fact reality goes beyond the physical systems that we observe, that the physical systems that we observe are their nature is dictated by the observation. They don't come into being even until observed. Or right, the system is dependent on the observation. The system, the definition of the system has to include the observation in it. Meaning if you observe things in a certain way, you get a certain result. I mean, that observation is, and the mind is, crucially important. Now, that's just a description from a modern scientific point of view, but from the point of view of our meditation, it doesn't really matter what people believe or what modern theory is, because clearly the mind is the most crucial aspect of the meditative experience, regardless of whether you believe that it has an effect on the world around you. Certainly has an effect on our experience. But this is important, and I think overlooked by beginner meditators, to their detriment or to their peril, at their peril. As we're talking a lot about results and trying to verify the success that one is having or has had with one's practice. And the problem with that, I mean, it's just an example really, but it's a good example, because the problem with that is when you start to wonder about your progress, when you start to wonder about the effects of the mind, let's put it this way, in a general sense, if you start to investigate, is the mind efficacious? Is my meditation having an effect on my life? That investigation is in and of itself efficacious, in a bad way. I mean, in an obstructive way, because you're no longer meditating. So what this means is, when a meditator begins to question their practice, I mean, this is the problem with doubt, really. When you begin to doubt your practice or question your practice, you're no longer able to observe your practice. You're no longer able to observe the benefits. And that's a big problem. So the way it plays out is a meditator will be practicing and getting good results. They will be learning things and their mind will be becoming clear. But then something comes up that triggers a response and they're no longer being mindful. And as soon as they stop being mindful, they start to question. Because they're falling into delusion. Their mind is no longer clear. They'll ask themselves, you know, oh, well, this bad thing came, there must be something wrong. That's our ordinary way of understanding bad things. Some pain came up, or my mind is being distracted, and it's uncomfortable, so there must be something wrong, and so you start to question. And as soon as you start to question, you're no longer being mindful. And because you're no longer being mindful, you're no longer getting any benefit. So it becomes a vicious spiral. You're not practicing, so you're not getting any benefit. You're not getting any benefit, so you don't think the practice is any good, is worth doing, so you don't practice, and so you don't get any benefit. This is why, I mean, it sounds like a tricky thing to say, that somehow I'm trying to avoid offering up any benefit to the meditation practice. But this is why you have to find benefit in the present moment. You have to see goodness rather than worrying about results in the future. You know, living in the future, living in the past. You find the benefit in the quality of the present moment, the quality of your present experience, the quality of your mind in the present moment. And you reassure yourself. You demand of yourself the honesty and the appreciation that a pure mind is a good thing, regardless of exactly what results it brings. You force yourself to accept the honest truth that a good state can only bring good things. And so you stop worrying about what are the results. But I bring this up because it's an interesting example of the efficacy of the mind, the importance of the state of mind, and how subtle and delicate is the state of meditation practice. I mean, and also how real it is. This isn't a game where you can sit back and look and see how you're doing, see what the score is. As soon as you step back and try to keep score, you're affecting the game. And there's no stepping out. And this goes with everything. When you take a break from the meditation practice, you don't take a break from life. So you start to cultivate unwholesomeness. So my teacher would, many times he said, he pointed out how karma works on the momentary level. He would say, every time that you're not mindful, there's delusion. When you like something, that's greed. When you dislike something, that's anger. When you're not mindful, whether you dislike it or like it, or don't dislike it, don't like it, there's delusion every moment. Our existence in samsara is not static, not the way we think it is, no? We think of ourselves as having a life, and we can live our lives and just, you know, coast through life. But we're constantly changing. We're constantly following our habits and cultivating habits. And so we're constantly becoming our habits. And so the importance of the mind, this is really the key in our practice, is to realize and to put into action the power of the mind. Make the mind work for us. Because as these suttas say, the first one says, I can see nothing. Nothing that is, I can see nothing more unwieldy, or nothing more useless, is probably, well, anattaya, that's the next one. Nothing more useless than the untrained mind. The untrained mind is of great, well, anatta may also mean detriment. The untrained mind is of great detriment. Unlike anything else, you know, the untrained body, well, there's lots of things you can do if your body is well trained. But no matter what you have in the physical world, no matter your wealth or your power, your physical prowess, your physical possessions, your physical stature, status and position and fame and glory, if your mind is useless, you are useless. All the physical wealth in the world is useless. On the other hand, if you have nothing, if you live on a park bench, but your mind is strong, your mind is wieldy, is cultivated, then you're invincible. You're omnipotent. That's not the right word, but you have perfect power. There's nothing that can shake you. Unshakable. And so these 10 suttas just go through different ways of saying that. It brings happiness. The trained mind brings happiness. The untrained mind leads to harm, leads to suffering. The uncultivated mind. And there's this word Padubhuta, which means made. Bhikkhu Bodhi translated as manifest, and he understands it as being applied, being used, being tapped. If you don't put your mind to use, you've wasted the greatest potential that we have to benefit and to prosper and to succeed in life, in everything we do. I mean, think about training your body even, right? Compare these two. How much of training your body is mental, right? The mental fortitude, the mental prowess to actually undertake the training and persist with the training. To succeed in business, to succeed in study, to succeed in relationships. How much of it is dependent on the mind? Everything we do. And yet, what do we do with our mind? Do we train it? Do we clean it? Do we care for it? We abuse it. We neglect it. We sully it. We feed it with garbage and junk, and we torture it. We repress it. We stretch it totally out of shape, and then we expect to find happiness. You see, the mind, and you feel this greater nowhere else than in meditation. Meditation, you can't. When you're sitting still, you know, when you've got nothing else to distract you, then your relationship with your mind is most important. If you become distracted, you'll feel it and start to get a headache. If you become desirous of this or that, you'll feel the heat, if you have anger or aversion, you have to deal with it. It's like a pressure cooker. All the emotions, all the mental upset and stress and defilement, it's all in there. So this is why when you meditate, you have to see things like doubt as a hindrance. You have to see things like desire and aversion and as hindrances. You can't entertain them, analyze and worry about them. If you want to really progress in meditation, everything has to be clinical and systematic. Everything has to be seen as an experience. Even your responses to the experiences, your interpretations. When you interpret something, the interpretation is also an experience. You can't see entities and you can't get caught up in things. Anyway. So this is about the mind. A little bit of Dhamma for tonight. How are we doing? Okay, I've got this neat dashboard here. And you've all got this great chat feature, which I'm kind of concerned about because now we're letting loose the floodgates, and that was what our website was for. It was meant to filter out meditators and non-meditators. Filter out non-meditators and leave us with only meditators. So I'm not sure I think we're going to take questions only from our website for now. You all can chat on YouTube, but if you don't sign up for our website and start meditating, sorry. Because it's just too much, you know. I've done this before and it gets too far, too broad-based. Or I never get anything done because I'm just answering question after question. So we're going back to our website. See if I can This is our website, meditation.sirimangalo.org. Okay, I want to tell you guys, don't argue so much. Our chat box is full of debates and discussions. Chill out. Okay, so some questions. Did you ever teach to people with schizophrenia or bipolar? If so, what was your experience? No, I've never had the honor. I may never, because we've got, of course, liability issues if I start to muck around with people who have... I don't know. I mean, I don't know that in Canada liability is such an issue, but could be. I would be happy to. I guess I know such people are really a prime subject for the meditation practice to see whether it works. Yeah, switch back here. I think this is a better view. No? Watch the monk. The monk will do the reading for you. Because, I mean, schizophrenia and bipolar, I think, are quite different. I'm not sure, but, like, schizophrenia is hallucinations, which are, you know, lead to paranoia and extremes of emotion. But bipolar is just extremes of emotion, right? Both of them are problematic in terms of the reactions to experiences. So it's a prime example of the importance of training the mind and to see things as they are and not judge them. You said in a listening to Dhamma video we should meditate while listening. Does it mean regular meditation with labeling as usual? And if we hear the words, yeah, just label hearing. You don't have to go back to the breath. You can stay with the hearing. If someone's shouting at you or even just talking to you. I mean, you don't have to even say it three times. You could just say it once. Especially in your daily life, it's, you know, it's a war zone, really, when you try to meditate during daily life. If you can get one clear awareness of this is hearing, this is seeing, this is thinking, good for you. But yeah, if someone's talking on and you're not too concerned about getting involved with what they say or responding, you can just say hearing. It makes you feel a lot better, more at peace, much better able to respond when they give you a turn. Perhaps hard to ingest and understand what they're saying and really contemplate it, but honestly, if you're mindful, you can get the gist of what people say and then, you know, keep it simple, keep it down to earth. You won't get caught up in there in any kind of mental ratiocination. Formal sitting meditation. So should we balance it with walking meditation? Yeah, balancing walking with sitting is more when you're doing a meditation intensively, because you can't just sit around all day. Now, if you're just doing meditation in daily life, you don't have to balance, and it doesn't mean that you have to balance as a rule, because you can meditate in any position. It's meaningless how much walking and how much sitting you do. What's nice about balancing walking and sitting is it challenges your partiality. If you're partial to sitting, it challenges you. If you're partial to walking, it challenges you by taking you out of your comfort zone, by forcing you to be flexible, by changing the condition, teaching you to deal with impermanence. I notice I have become more intolerant of loud noises after I began meditating. Isn't the opposite supposed to happen? Yes, the opposite is supposed to happen. I mean, in the beginning, I've talked about this. In the beginning, you're just allowing yourself to have reactions rather than reacting. Like, you have a reaction, I don't like this, so you run away from it. Instead, you're allowing the reaction to come. So let that come up. When you dislike loud noises, focus on the disliking. The other thing is your mind is much more focused, so you're able to see the experiences clearer, so they seem more intense. But they should, in general, be more intense because you're allowing them to happen. You're allowing your mind to, you know, you're studying the nature of your mind, so you're no longer reacting to your reactions and trying to avoid them. Distract yourself. You're no longer distracting yourself from your actions. You're focusing on them. So you're getting to see them. And rather than reacting to them, just let them be. When you're angry, let it be anger. Say angry, angry. But eventually, yeah, you should become more tolerant. But again, you know, if you're worrying about you're not getting good results, that worrying is getting in the way of your meditation. And you won't be able to see results that way. If you want to see the benefit of the meditation, it has to be the benefit of the moment of meditation, when you're mindful at that moment. You can't look at it from a protracted, am I getting better point of view, because the mind is very complicated. It gets better, it gets worse, it's got all sorts of mess and jumble of good and bad things inside. I understand how meditation affects future karma, but could you explain how it affects past karma? It doesn't affect past karma. It affects the results of past karma. So if you've done something bad, but then you do something good, well, sometimes the good thing you do can cancel it out. Meditation is a good thing, so it can affect bad and good things you've done in the past, affect the results of those things. Certainly can't affect the karma. The karma is done. How do you deal with hunger pains? I'm on my third day of not eating after 12, and it's harder than I thought. You know, you should really only do that if you're doing intensive meditation. Otherwise, yeah, it should be probably pretty difficult. I mean, I guess you learn to eat a lot more in the morning. I eat quite a bit in the morning. But yeah, it gets easier. It's mostly easy when you're doing meditation, when you're living a life that's not stressful. If you have to work all day, like I was doing 8 precepts and I was eating only in the morning, and then I needed to get money to go to Thailand. This is when I actually ended up becoming a monk. And so I spent the summer tree planting and ate 4 meals a day. Because you had to, it's quite strenuous work. Do you ever think it's a good idea to take a break from meditation? At times I felt like I needed to take a step back and I've taken a week off or so. Could be. It's more likely if you don't have a teacher, because it's easy to get on the wrong path. It's easy to practice in a way that makes you more stressed. You know, that you're just plowing ahead like an ox and not actually practicing correctly. So sometimes stepping back and trying again. In fact, in a sense, meditation is always like that. It's about trying, doing it wrong, trying again, doing it wrong, you know, giving up, and then trying it a new way, trying it with a fresh view. Because meditation is about changing the nature of your mind, the way we react to things. So in the beginning, your meditation is going to be all wrong, all wrong. You have to step back and start over, try again. And you'll slowly begin to change the way you meditate. That's key. It's not like you start meditating and just keep doing it that way and you'll get results. That's not what meditation is. Meditation is changing who you are. So therefore also changing how you meditate. Your meditation will change. The way you meditate will change if you're progressing. I'm worried that I might accumulate aversion against meditation over time and eventually give up. How can I prevent this? Don't try to prevent anything. If you have aversion towards meditation, great, that's a good object of meditation. If you're worried that you might accumulate aversion against meditation, that's great, that's worry. Good for you to see it. Learn about that worry. Come to see that that worry is the problem and that worry is stressful for you. And once you give up that worry, you will be happier, you will be more at peace. I mean, you don't have to go through all that, just say to yourself, worried, worried, and you'll be able to see all of that. Your mind will become clear and you'll feel better. When you do have aversion towards your meditation, just say, disliking, disliking. You see, this is the mind, you can't step out like that. At the time when you have aversion towards meditation, that's an important time to meditate. It's important that you meditate on that. Just to clarify, you advise to do formal meditation while listening to Dhamma talks. I do. I definitely do. It is possible to have great meditative great meditative results. You can attain Nibbana when listening to the Dhamma. You can become enlightened listening, if you meditate listening to the Dhamma. It's a great opportunity, because whatever the teacher is saying, if it's about the Dhamma, it will keep bringing you back to the present moment. So do meditate during the talk. There was this guy. You see this picture, I think it's in the video, right? You can see him? Yeah. This guy up here, he always says, if you listen to his talks, he's passed away, but his talks are on MP3, and he'll say, you can put your hands down, I'm going to give a talk, put your hands down, and while you're listening, note at the ear, hearing, hearing, and then he'll explain why that's the best way to listen to the Dhamma. There's different reasons for listening to the Dhamma. Some people just do it to get knowledge. Some people do it just to, because they know it's a good thing, so they do it for the good karma of listening to the Dhamma. But if you want to do it to become enlightened, you have to practice. It has to be a meditation practice. Is it beneficial to meet a very accomplished meditator, Sotapanna and beyond? Yeah, sure. It's quite beneficial, right? Pandita-ananca sevana, associating with the wise, samana-ananca dasanang, to see the recklesses, people who are association with the wise, good friendship. All the Buddha talked about these quite often, you know, all these things, talked about how great they are. But Ajahn Tong gives good advice that is memorable. In his he once gave this talk, and it was recorded and turned into a book, adapted into a book, where he said,
การเข้าไปหาพระอริยเจ้าก็ดีการอยู่กับพระอริยเจ้าก็ดีไม่ดีเท่าการกระทำให้ตนเองให้เป็นพระอริยเจ้า
something like that, which means whether going to see an enlightened being or staying with an enlightened being, neither of these are as good as becoming an enlightened being yourself. Who is the monk in the picture? That's Lumpo Chodok. Chodok, which would be Jotika. Jotaka. Jotaka, I guess, was his name. Chodok, they say in Thai. He was a number one Pali scholar in Thailand. Apparently, I heard a story about the year he became the top level Pali, he was the only one who passed the exams. And the funny thing is that he didn't actually pass. He did the top level Pali exams, and then he went to Burma to practice meditation. This is what I've heard. I don't know. It's just hearsay, but this monk who actually lived with him was telling me the story. And he said he was off in Burma, and then the people were marking all these exams, and they found that not a single person had passed the exams that year. And they couldn't have that. Someone had to pass. So they tried to find who was least wrong, who failed the least. The exams are really that hard. And he was the one who failed the least. So he got the top level Pali. But at that time he was off in Burma, and he was practicing meditation. And he practiced meditation in Bangkok. Actually, it's not true. He practiced meditation in Bangkok and went to Burma to see how they did things there as well. But his practice was mostly in Bangkok. But he became, after Asaba, this very important monk went to prison, he became the head meditation teacher in Bangkok. I've heard the phrase about transcending the three realms.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's a topic for a long discourse, probably. But basically the three realms are the kama vachara, the realm of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, and feeling. The realm of coarse materiality, of sensual pleasures, of sense desires, of the enjoyment of seeing and hearing and smelling and tasting and feeling. The rupa vachara is form, the realm of fine material, or form where there is form, but not sensuality. So there's no sex, there's no eating and drinking and listening to music, there's just form, mind and body. And then there's the arupa vachara, which is just mind, no body, no form. So the arupa vachara and arupa vachara, the form and formless, these are the Brahma realms, these are God realms. So there are God realms that have form, and there are God realms that don't have form. But you have to kind of, you have to go into more detail about how you get there and what they're involved and what they exactly mean. It's involving, to get a really good discussion, you have to learn the Abhidhamma, I think. Okay, well, this is great. It's been fun trying this out. We'll have to see how it works. See what the response is. I don't know, I mean, this is a whole new interface, but I got this neat app that I can use, you see? So I can put things like this here. We've got this. I could put some fancy introduction screen someday, and I can do a desktop. I can show you my desktop, and it fades in and out, and I've got multiple audio sources. Really neat app. It's open source for Linux. Anyway, I'm going to stop there. So wish you all a good night, and hope to see you all tomorrow. If you have any questions that I haven't answered, please feel free to ask them again. I wasn't purposefully ignoring you. It's just time to go. So have a good night. Wishing you all the best.